someone mentioned to me, and I shan't say who mentioned it.
Who was it though?
I'd be in a lot of trouble if I did actually say it. Yeah.
Hello and welcome to another telecoms.com podcast. Just to remind you, if you're listening on SoundCloud or iTunes, you can also watch the video on YouTube or on our site, and vice versa. If you're watching the video, you can download it on SoundCloud or iTunes. This week I have with me Jamie Davis, as ever.
Hello, Scott.
And the enormous pleasure of Ray LeMaitre, who was conspicuously absent last week, from Light Reading. Hi, Ray.
Hello.
So this week we're going to be talking about whether 3UK has the right to challenge the 5G auction we're having here. We're going to ask whether we have any control over our digital lives. And we're also going to ask whether telcos have got a clue about what's going on in their networks. Now, the 3UK one, that's me. So I'll introduce myself. Scott, over to you. All right, thanks, Scott. And I'm going to say that the 3 finally came up with its, I can't remember what the technical term is, some kind of judicial inquiry or
judicial
whatever.
Review.
Review, there we go. Into the circumstances of the 5G auction. So just to give everyone a bit of background, a little what 3's been banging on about how unfair it is that people like EE and Vodafone have got loads more of the UK available useful spectrum than it has. And it's had this bizarre campaign, hashtag make the air fair and all that sort of thing. It even did a cartoon.
Super Sharon, yeah.
Yeah, even did a cartoon of the head of Ofcom, Sharon White, in some kind of absurd superhero uniform, somehow imploring her to save the day. And by save the day, they basically mean force everyone else to give 3 some more spectrum.
Or, now, or stop and don't allow them to buy any more spectrum.
Don't allow them to buy any more. And that takes the form of what it would like to be is an absolute cap on the amount of spectrum that any one operator can own in the UK, and it wanted that cap to be 30%. Right now, I think EE has about 42% or something like that.
Yeah.
So obviously, that requires a fair bit of redistribution. I called it spectrum socialism in a story I wrote a little while ago. Fair bit of redistribution from EE to 3. And what goes unsaid is O2 as well, which has a similar amount, about 15% of the spectrum. And obviously, he didn't think this was a good idea. And
Vodafone kicked up a fuss as well.
Vodafone kicked up a bit of a fuss. Can't remember in what direction fuss was kicked.
They're over the spectrum cap as well.
So yeah, a little bit.
They're about 34-35%, I think,
something
isn't
like
it?
Yeah. So they weren't happy. And Ofcom, as the arbiter of these things, was forced to make a call, and they went, all right, we're going to cap it at 37%. And you'd think that was a sort of happy little medium, but, you know, 3 obviously wasn't happy because it didn't get 30%. E wasn't really that happy because it means it can't get more spectrum, certainly in one round of auctions. And that's fine. That's going to happen. When you've got to adjudicate, when you've got to meet in the middle, you can't please all the people all the time. But now what's happened is that 3... he's taking it to the courts and challenging the decision. Now, the big criticism of that, you'd think, fair enough, if they're not happy, do something about it. And you could say that. It certainly beats drawing silly cartoons. But the major briefing that the likes of Ofcom are having against this is it's going to delay the whole 5G process in the UK and thus basically put us behind the whole world and relegate us to back to the sort of medieval times or whatever. So, our angle, Jamie, your angle, generally when you've been writing about 3 and it's moaning, hasn't been massively sympathetic, has it?
No. I mean, I've got no sympathy for them. I've got sympathy for challenger brands who come in and are struggling against the incumbents, because the financial weight of, let's have a look at a hypothetical situation. 3 come into the UK market and the financial weight of BT/EE and Vodafone and O2 meant that they couldn't compete.
Yep.
Now, in that situation, I would have sympathy for them. And I think, there should be a bit of encouragement from the regulator to help them level the playing fields.
But, as I believe there was.
Yeah, but like CK Hutchison, or however you pronounce it, from Hong Kong, is a multi-billion pound or Hong Kong dollar business, which is one. He's the guy who owns it is one of the richest guys in the world.
Sure,
they make ridiculous amounts of money. So the fact that 3 can't compete financially is because they're not funding it. Yep. I mean, they have the money to compete on a financial footing at the Spectrum, but they at the Spectrum auction, but it just looks like they don't want to. And the other, I mean, three, you know, they're just constantly complaining. Yeah. I mean, there's nothing. They're like, it's like that guy down the pub who just never has a good day. You know, you say, oh, how's your week been? Yeah, it's all right. You know, it's a bit wet. All right, okay. Middle of June, how's your week been? Well, you know, I was a bit sweaty on the tube. You know, there's just nothing. There's nothing good about
or
three.
Or the football fan who every time his team loses, it's because the ref was
biased. Yeah, yeah,
or something
yeah.
like that.
It's ridiculous. I mean, I think there's other reasons for this review, but I mean, ultimately, they're trying to skew the regulatory and and sort of like rulemakers to favour them. But sorry, carry on.
That's all right. So Ray, on the other hand, it can't be fair for one company to have almost three times as much spectrum as the other. What do you think of this whole issue?
I think Ofcom has obviously made an initial ruling that has tried to even things up. Three clearly unsatisfied. I think now going down the legal route, I don't think it's going to do the whole thing about, oh, this might delay the award of 5G spectrum. That's just a red herring. I don't think it's going to make any difference whatsoever. But all it's going to do, I think, is ultimately financially penalise Three itself. It'll end up spending a lot of money. I don't think it's going to get anything out of it. No. If there is a set of judges somewhere that do rule in its favour, there will be appeals, and it will open up a whole can of worms of the other companies going, well, let's go and review all of the other processes and see if the judges rule in favour of that. What about that thing back in the 1970s where we got screwed over?
Yeah.
And it will open up a can of worms. So I think this is not a good route to go down for anybody, in fact, but including Three. So I think they're shooting themselves in the foot.
I think one interesting thing that someone mentioned to me, and I shan't say who mentioned it.
Who was it, though?
I'd be in a lot of trouble if I did actually say it.
Yeah,
but it was an off-the-record comment that highlighted the UK broadband acquisition. So basically the theory is that UK broadband gives them some leeway in the 5G fight. But Three hasn't optimised its kit for that spectrum band that it acquired, or the licences it acquired as part of the UK broadband deal. So kicking off this review gives it a little bit more time to optimise the kit so it can actually be 5G ready with the assets it's already acquired. It's a massive conspiracy theory. It'll probably never be proved false or accurate, but you know, it's a nice little.
Well,
it's a nice little. I mean,
it's consistent.
It's a green herring.
It's consistent with the general view that these sorts of challenges are usually not about what they appear to be on the surface. It might be something strategic, like you were just describing, Jamie, or it might just be an attempt to acquire bargaining chips in some other future sort of adjudication or something like that. But what does seem to be clear is that they're not getting much sympathy anywhere. So I think would be quite a funny thing? If we use our little bell thing to argue for and against it, I've got a feeling the argument for it is going to be quite short. In fact, I'm going to give Ray that privilege. Ray, you've got 30 seconds to argue in favour of Three's judicial review, starting now.
I have no argument in favour of Three's judicial review.
I told you it'd be short. Jamie, your argument against it.
Well, if you look at all the other legal proceedings that have predated this judicial review, I think that Three is just shooting itself in the foot. So, it's opening up a can of worms that everyone else... No, seriously, I think it's basically Three are just being moaning. They don't want to contribute money and actually battle on an evil ground. I just don't think... I think they're just being moany little bastards.
Steady. Cool. Okay, moving on. do we have any control over our digital lives? So, Jamie, you've been writing about this week. You went to an event. You've been chatting to various people. So what's going on with our digital lives?
Yeah, it's quite... So I was at CloudSec earlier this week, and it was a really good event, actually. Really enjoyed it. And one of the websites that was really brought to my attention, and I'd recommend everyone having a look at it, because it's quite... I didn't realise I'd been breached quite a few times, but it's called,
so to speak,
as you do.
Where's this video going?
So it's called Have I Been... Right, I don't know how to pronounce this. Have I Been Pwned?
Yeah. It's owned, but with a P. It's yeah, Pwned. Internet speak. Yeah.
It's Have I PWNED.com. And basically, you type in your any email address, and it shows how often that email address has been associated with a breach. And I think... the bigger argument is, or the bigger point is, how many people actually have an understanding of their digital footprints and what the digital economy actually means to us as consumers. Yeah. So if we start with the second one, what it means to us as consumers, if you say data is the new oil, algorithms are a new refinery, and our personal information is how we're going to pay for things. So we give away personal information instead of paying for services, information. How often do you keep track of that information that you're giving away? I mean, for instance, how many apps, I know you're not going to know this off the top of your head, how many apps have you downloaded for your phone over the last 2 years? What,
loads?
100?
I'm sure you can download an app that would tell you that.
Yeah, possibly can. But I mean, my point is, like, I got no idea. I mean, how many times have you downloaded a game, or I've done this quite a few times, realised the game is absolute pony, and then just deleted it straight away? Mm-hmm. But you've basically given your details for that 5 minutes to that company. So a lot of people don't know where about their digital footprint, because they're just giving their details away willy-nilly, just absolutely everywhere. So everyone could be a potential...
And why is it bad for us to not be on top of this?
I mean, you can have something... there could be a breach and you've got no idea that you're involved with it. I mean, your details, like...
A breach being where your details are just
leaked onto the dark web.
Which happens all the time.
Yeah.
We just had one as we speak. But they seem to happen every day, and they're normally accompanied by all the predictable press releases from security companies.
Yeah. But for instance, like, if HSBC got breached... I've got a HSBC bank account. Yeah. If they got breached...
You've just given some personal data away there, by the way.
Yeah. Fine. You can blank that out, Pierre. If they got breached, I'd know about it. But what about some Mickey Mouse little game developer in the Philippines that I once downloaded a game, and they get breached, and all of a sudden my personal information there is out, and I've got no control over that because I've got no awareness that they have my personal information. So... EU GDPR, those sorts of things, it gives the consumer more control, but there's just literally no awareness about what our impression on the digital economy is at the moment.
Is this is the control over your sort of digital presence something that keeps you awake at night, right?
Nothing keeps me awake at night, Scott. No, I think
that's because you've your aggressive drinking habit.
I think... I'm not sure that anybody, apart from the people who've completely cut themselves off from any kind of digital lifestyle, I'm not sure anybody really knows how much where their information is stored or how much it's travelled. But even if they do, what we don't know is how that's going to come back and impact our digital lives in 1, 3, 5, 10 years' time.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I mean, I joked about you can probably download an app that can tell you where your information is. I mean, that is something I think that everybody, you know, should have, and it should be freely available, and people should be encouraged to have. Because I think it'd be quite shocking for a lot of people to find out where their information is stored, or, you know, how many how many email accounts they have and what's going on with those accounts, I think, you know, would be a starting point. Who's got a Hotmail account they've forgotten about that's currently being used to, you know, spam the world with the latest offer of a 20 million, you know, bank account in Nigeria or some Viagra, all that kind of stuff. So I think it's all about, it's really all about education. I think when people sign up to any new service as part of getting the email to verify, there should be information in there about, you know, do you know about your digital footprint? You know, you can get that information here so that people can become more aware.
Yeah, and I think there probably should be a bit more of a bit more of an onus on the companies themselves to not just make you read a ton of small print, which no one does bothers, but just sort of maybe update you a bit more and just sort of keep you informed. I mean, my biggest thing about this, and when Jamie and I were chatting about it earlier on this week, was, and people talk a lot about your data being new currency and your, you know, your digital identity being hoarded out by all these big internet companies. And obviously, it's not nice to feel that there's some aspect of your sort of public persona that's not within your control. But I also sometimes wonder whether how it affects me. For example, like advertising. So you got like Google and Facebook make tons of money out of advertising, and they supposedly, by seeing what I do, what I like, by sort of sifting through, using algorithms, sift through my emails, whatever, they can send more targeted ads to me, which is how the ad industry supposedly been revolutionized. But I don't see much evidence of it. I don't see, certainly nothing predictive. But the best I see is suddenly get served with an ad for something on Amazon that I just bought. So it's a sort of reactive algorithm rather than proactive. It doesn't seem to be anticipating anything. I suppose it would be a bit scary if it did. And suddenly you find yourself buying all this stuff you didn't know you wanted, but they didn't seem anywhere near doing all that yet. So on that side, I'm pretty relaxed about it. But yeah, you know, Ray made a good point.
I think one of the things, like on Facebook in particular, I think they've always been pretty good at relating where you are now to sort of like what you might want. So like a good example is like a couple of, well, I think last year, one of my mates noted that he or his partner put engaged on the Facebook profile, and all of a sudden all the adverts were dressmakers.
But that's still quite rudimentary, isn't it? All this talk of AI and algorithms and general cleverness, I don't think you've got to be, you know, one of those AI things that beats people at Go or Dota 2 to work out if someone's engaged. They might want to buy some wedding shit. But, you know, there you go. But the point I was just going to make now, that Ray said about your sort of digital footprint in the long term, you know, we're in an era where a lot of people's lives are being affected, often negatively, by something they might have said or done online. It's often taken out of context and used to sort of denounce them. You know, what if one day you signed up to some slightly politically dodgy site or whatever, or even worse, you know, it became in the public domain what kind of filth you might be looking at online. And then, but then your online reputation can get properly trashed and you can lose jobs and all that sort of thing. So that's, believe me, I'm not talking about myself here. I'm obviously squeaky clean. But for other people with slightly more sordid online existences, I'm not looking at anyone in particular here.
I mean, that's part of one of the other things that was brought up. There's a new website called attorney.me.
Right.
Now, basically, you can sign up, and there's about 30-odd thousand people that have done this, and you sign up, and this AI tracker basically just keeps tabs on your social media networks. When you die, the AI takes over your online life and creates a virtual you which will never die. Now that's, but it's but it's something worth thinking about, because like half the time, like this, I mean, one thing,
I just thought about it.
Yeah, but social media accounts. Have you ever thought about what happens to your Facebook page after you die? Like, very few people have. It's not a particularly nice thought.
No.
But if someone doesn't think about it,
they start spamming you with ads for coffins and stuff.
No, but imagine, like, no one reports that you've died. That is a profile that someone who wants to steal your identity and potentially commit fraud elsewhere in the world, which is, like you're saying, in 5 to 10 years' time, we'll start to feel the impact of what this is. Like, that's an authentication tool for a lot of people at the moment, a Facebook account. So they could, that in theory could be used to, you know, to create a new identity and commit fraud and elsewhere in the world.
So it's all portentous stuff. So yeah, to summarise that, my view, I'm not generally in favour of trying to sort of impose arbitrary regulation on private companies, but maybe if, you know, these big internet companies like Facebook and Google make a hell of a lot of money from mining our data, maybe they should be required to take a bit more responsibility for the sort of protection of our digital identities, or at least empowering us more. I think they do it a little bit, you know, they give you all these tools, but whoever goes into Facebook and looks at all those various tools they can do, and you can argue that if you can't be asked to do that, then you deserve to not have any protection. But I suspect they could make it easier for us.
Yeah.
Okay, so we got one more topic here. Ray wants to talk about dirty data.
Actually, I think it was Dirty Dancing.
Oh, was it?
That I said.
But then I vetoed it and said, for God's sake, make it relevant to the subject matter.
Yeah, well, I mean, I always have the time of my life when I come on this podcast, so I'm prepared to talk about dirty data. Now, this is a, I would say about 16 or 17 years back when I had, I first went to a telecom software industry event, and the first person
I
spoke to...
16 or 17 years?
Yeah.
Oh, dear.
I've got to warn you, Ray.
When I was still at school.
Jamie is guilty of ageism at times.
I won't tell you sort of what year I was in at that point.
And that's just when that's when they first let me out of the office after two decades. But and the first person I spoke to was about the topic of dirty data, how accurate the information is that network operators hold on their networks, right, and how much they actually know about their networks. And certainly, you know, in the early 2000s, the consensus was that some operators really had only about 50% accuracy about the information about their networks, and that the ones who were really on top of it might have 80 to 85% accuracy. Right. So I think over the years, things have got better with the introduction of IP networks and the deployment of new networks. That's enabled companies to get a better handle on the information, just knowing what they've got hooked up, you know, in different parts of their network. But also, you know, if you've got a 16 port bit of kit, how many of those ports are live and being used, and what they're actually set up for, all this kind of information. Now, if you consider the current trend around virtualization, and particularly the move towards autonomous networks, where you're going to let software decide how the networks are configured and how the services are set up. Well, if you haven't got accurate information about your networks, how is a piece of software using inaccurate information going to set up the right services for the right customers with all the right information? It's not going to happen. So I think we are about to hit a new era of concern or scrambling by the network operators, trying to figure out, do we actually know what we've got, and how do we go about convincing ourselves even that we have 100% accurate information about our network? Because at the moment, a lot of operators, I mean, they don't, and they employ vendors to manually go and visit their points of presence in their network and go and test every single bit of gear to find out what's there and what's working.
So hold on, operators over-promising. Shut the front door, I mean, that can't be happening. I mean,
how do you mean over-promising?
Well, I mean, you know, it sounds like they're overreaching. They're, you know, they've got this idea, but they haven't got the fundamentals in place to actually facilitate it.
You mean with the autonomous?
We're very early doors on the move towards autonomy. There's going to autonomous networking is going to require an awful lot of evolution of the systems already there. But I think they're starting to realise that, you know, they can do the next 3 or 4 years of implementing virtualization capabilities, and having SDN controllers and orchestration software. But at the end of the day, if they don't actually, they're starting to realize now, if they don't actually know what they've got, then all of that is pointless.
Totally.
But currently, when they if they employ a, I was speaking to a vendor the other day who said, well, when we engage with a new company and we're going to upgrade their network, the first thing we need to do is find out, you know, what's currently out in the network, and they physically have to do it.
There's no inventory. There's no spreadsheet.
Well, there are. There's like they usually end up with, oh, here's a database, but then here's some spreadsheets, and then here's a big paper plan that unfolds over a whole table to show what we think we have in this particular neighborhood because we bought that company 5 years ago and we're still not sure
really
what we bought.
Integrated it properly, yeah.
And they actually employ these vendors then to spend 3 months and millions of dollars and thousands of man hours literally visiting their network to find out what the hell they've got. That there's got to be a better way.
So is that, I mean, does that transfer across to sort of like customer data as well?
Customer data is easier to track and manage because it's constantly being updated. But there's, I mean, there are still issues there. It's easier to deal with. But for example, I've been a Virgin Media customer, NTL, and then Virgin Media for about 15 or 16 years. And only a couple of years ago did they stop sending me marketing information asking me if I wanted to be their customer.
Indeed.
So it took them that long to realize I was already a customer and that they were wasting their money.
So there's a central paradox in all this. I was writing about an Ericsson sort of autonomous car thing this week, and there's a sort of Ericsson quote they like to use about how something like 95% of accidents are due to human error, which stands to reason, really, doesn't it? It makes you wonder what the other 5% are.
So people who get their dogs to drive the car, they're just not reliable.
Yeah. And that's used as evidence of why AI is good, because we're basically a bit shit. We're a bit inefficient. We're easily distracted. We're chatting on our phone. We're daydreaming about the next episode of Game of Thrones or whatever. Whereas good old computers, you know, they're always on the job. They don't need to eat. They don't need to rest. They're 100% efficient and all that sort of thing, which may or may not be true. But as you point out, Ray, we still need to program those computers. We still need to give them data.
Yeah.
And you can have the most clever bit of AI, but if it's working on a flawed platform...
Or it's given the wrong instructions.
Well, indeed. Or it becomes autonomous and self-aware and decides to launch nukes. No, sorry, that's one of my tangents there. So yeah, I mean, AIs. I was looking when we think about this podcast. We've written about sort of 3 or 4 AI stories this week, and they seem to be coming with greater frequency. And they all have this sort of utopian: everything's going to be great once we let the computers take over. You know, we did have one other thing. In fact, we were chatting about this earlier. I might go off on this tangent. We were talking about AI replacing people in the workplace, and what an issue that is from an HR point of view. And that's another one. So not only is AI supposed to be so flawless that you no longer need people, but then if you no longer need people, what are people going to do?
Well, but at the same time, I mean, there's always going to be a role for humans. You know, everyone would have thought of this.
Just not as many humans as currently.
Yeah, everyone would have thought of this thought the same thing a couple of hundred years ago. I mean, this is no different from us replacing, like, instead of us rowing a boat, you know, like across the canal/channel, we're using a motor. So this is the next step of evolution. You know, at that point it was replacing human muscles with machine, and now we're replacing human mind with machine, admittedly for mundane tasks. I mean, the next big thing is that when they can, you know, in God knows how many years, when they actually manage to replicate the power of the brain, and they can start doing jobs that are beyond the mundane and start doing like journalism. Although saying that, I still think that there are a few titles. Well, I'm not going to say who they are.
Such a tease.
There's a few titles that can probably be replaced by AI right now.
Like, do you know, I actually wrote in a story today that ZTE might consider using AI to write its press releases, because they'd almost certainly do a better job.
But yeah, anything that's generic, I'm not saying who the news outlet is, but anything that's generic has zero analysis or opinion in it. I mean, a machine could do that.
Yeah, you know, when it's just rearranging the words in the press release.
Exactly. How do you know it isn't already?
Yeah, might well be. Might well be.
Have you seen that writer for a while?
Well, I mean, there's...
Maybe they had their digital identity appropriated by a machine. Oh, my God, it started.
I think there's one massive title. Can I say it?
Yeah, go on, say it. What are you talking about?
Like, you look at the majority of the news stories that are on the BBC website. I mean, they're just so beige and fact, and it's informing. There's no opinion or analysis because, you know, it's a public service, so they can't lean left or right when it comes to politics or anything like that. So
they still get accused of it, so they might as well.
But it's so matter of fact, a lot of their stories, like football reporting, it's so matter of fact, you know, that there's no reason a computer could do that. It couldn't do that.
So we got this dilemma where, you know, I take your point about the Industrial Revolution. There's always been progress. There's always been automation. There's always been a desire for greater efficiency, which basically means getting the same job done by less people.
Yeah.
And we've found a way. But I still think that there's some genuine concern, hopefully not for our profession right now, although our profession has all sorts of other challenges beyond automation. But yes, as you say, the slightly more mundane, repetitive jobs, increasingly, you know, we see a lot of AI to do with customer care and call centres and all that sort of thing. And let's not forget the call centres in a lot of, like the UK, for example, call centres are where people who sort of fell out of primary or secondary, like working down the mines or whatever, ended up getting retrained to go and work in call centres or something like that. And so that now that's being automated. What do they go off and retrain to do? So I think it's a genuine concern. It'll probably get sorted out. We don't want to get too hysterical. But I think people are entitled.
I do. I mean, I think there are certain...
Lose your shit right here, right now.
I mean, there are certain jobs that, yeah, you can see that are going to get replaced. But there's also qualified jobs that are going to get replaced. And I think that'll shock people.
Yeah.
Like bookmakers or clerical staff.
Yeah, well, they reckon they're quite
law
statty
firms or
accountants,
like that.
Insurance underwriters, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I mean, that could be gone. A load of those jobs could be wiped out.
Yeah, the trend I see at the moment is major companies who have very large headcounts are trying to persuade the world currently that the introduction of automation is not going to impact jobs, and that is
they'll still have the same number of jobs.
No, they won't. It's just they're bullshit.
They're creating new jobs.
They will create some.
Yeah.
But not as many as they will get rid of. They just don't want to scare the workforce currently, and they're not doing a very good job at convincing the world that this isn't going to have an impact on headcount. I think they need to be a bit more upfront about it.
That's what it's perfect PR work, really, isn't it? They're saying, don't worry, AI will create these jobs. And so, you know, and we're doing a bit to retrain our current staff, but 90% of the time, the person who's doing the mundane job that's going to be sort of replaced by the machine, they're not going to be an ideal candidate for the data scientist job which has been created. You know, so like you said,
it's not light for
they're
light.
They're glossing over. That's what, I mean, and like you said, they don't want to scare them too much.
And I think it's partly because they don't really know, because, you know, for a lot of, if you're a very, very large company, yes, there might be people who aren't suitable to be retrained, but that also, you know, the introduction of automation might give some very large companies the opportunity to branch into a new area of business that they're not currently in using their existing workforce. And it depends then how they plan that efficiently, and if they have a very good training plan in place. But I'm not sure anybody has at the moment, but large companies will be looking at this and thinking, do we want to get rid of a whole load of people? How much would that cost us? What is the opportunity here maybe to develop new areas of business?
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, you know.
But people are generally stupid and they probably won't.
But they're people who like to make money. So you give them
the opportunity.
That's what it's all about.
Let's not forget, this is what it's only about. Nobody really gives a damn.
When you look at sort of quarterly earnings calls and that sort of thing, quite often the thing they're most proud about is greater efficiency and lowering overheads and all that sort of thing.
Great quarter, guys. Can you give me some more colour on that?
Yeah. We made a bunch more people completely redundant through that machine in the corner there.
And I will invest in your stock.
Excellent. I'm happy. I'm a happy capitalist. Cool. Okay. Well, that's sort of slightly ominous. No, I think I'll just sign off by saying, hopefully, they will never come up with a computer that can replicate three people talking shit in a room. On that note.
Yeah.
And until then, see you next time.